and welcome into the Who's On podcast, part of the Sabre Podcast Network. As always, go to thesabre.com to read all the latest about the Wahoos, from feature stories, analysis, and yes, the message board. And that was certainly rocking after Saturday's game. Again, follow, subscribe to the Who's On podcast, Apple, Spotify, and leave a five-star review while you're there. Now, without further ado, introducing our guest today is Mike Barber from the Richland Times-Dispatch, covering the Cavaliers, as well as a litany of other things, it seems like, this fall. Mike, just thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk a little football, and we were on another show this morning. I was talking about the fact that we've got enough games now that, like, we actually know what we're talking about. We're not just guessing and overreacting.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what today is, because just on the Sabre.com, just on Monday, I posted an article about some of the worrying trends for this Virginia team through three games, and a lot of those kind of reared their ugly head, you could say, against Maryland. Just diving into the recap real quick, obviously the final score there, 27-13, Maryland wins in a primetime matchup on ACC Network at Scott Stadium. We'll start off with a no-show in the second half for Virginia. Got outscored 20-0, and a lot of this comes back to the third quarter troubles this Virginia team has been having this season. They've been outscored 23-7 in the third quarter this year. Obviously, that includes all three games, and that is the only quarter they've been outscored this season. Every other quarter, they have a pretty lengthy lead, except for the fourth quarter. It's like a 14-13 difference. But what do you think about just the woes that they've been having coming out of the halftime break?
Yeah, Preston, it's really interesting because coaches talk about focusing on that middle eight and that kind of stuff. And Virginia's actually been really good going into the half. For whatever reason, that momentum doesn't carry. And it was interesting. Tony Elliott said to us after the game on Saturday, you know, the least important statistic in football is the halftime score. And if you're going to be better at one point or the other, I think you'd rather struggle going into the half, make your adjustments and come out. Look, and you don't want to overreact and you don't want to bang on anyone too much, but I thought Saturday Virginia was outcoached by Maryland, and that was the reason things changed coming out of halftime. I mean, I thought the adjustments that Maryland made were really smart and really worked. And Virginia, a little bit in their defense here, I think things were working. So maybe they weren't prepared for some of the adjustments that came their way. But it is a discouraging trend and something you're going to have to flip, because it doesn't matter how you feel going into that locker room if you're going to throw it away the minute you get back out on the field.
Yeah, and Tyler Neville, the tight end, said, you know, they had all the excitement, the momentum going into the halftime locker room. And, you know, Tony Elliott said both weeks, like, he felt good coming out. Like, he thought they, you know, were in a good spot energy-wise, focus-wise, to come out and execute kind of what they talked about at halftime. Both weeks, though, it has not looked that way. Looking at, I guess, just what was the moment this game kind of flipped for you?
Yeah, I don't know that it ever did, because it felt like, I mean, the first half felt like Virginia dominated and the scoreboard didn't show it, right? And in the second half, you're watching Maryland and you're thinking, okay, they're in control now, but also not dominating. I think what flipped for me, and it was just simply offensive play calling, I started to lose confidence in Virginia when they stopped running the football. Going into this game, I will admit, I thought the opposite. I thought they're not going to be able to run it into that Maryland front. It's a very stout defensive front. I thought they'd have trouble, and they were going to have to come out and do almost reverse football, right? Instead of setting up the pass with the run, they were going to have to reverse it. Well, instead, they came out, they were committed to the run. And in that first half, I should have had the numbers in front of me, but I think that X Brown and Kobe Pace combined for like 72 yards on something like 14 carries. Preston, in the second half, those two guys got four combined carries. And it was when I was watching possession after possession and they weren't running the football, that's when I started to think, hey, it's not just about a couple things didn't go your way or Maryland made a big play. You're not doing what got you control of this game. And so when I saw them get away from Pace and Brown, that's where I really thought, hey, I don't like the direction this game is headed.
I would say, yeah, and it's interesting looking at the win probability that ESPN has on there. They kind of flipped when Anthony Calandria had that big pass to Trell Harris to get them, you know, kind of down the field. And that's when it started to favor Virginia for the first time in this game. And that kind of held all the way up until, you know, the third quarter when, you know, Maryland comes out, they score a touchdown. But I would say that fumble in the red zone that Virginia had, where it looked like Blake Steen's foot came up and kicked the ball out of Anthony Calandria's hand, he didn't look like the same player after that. I know they had some drives later on. You know, they came back and got a field goal and got a touchdown kind of later towards the end of the half, but it kind of just seemed like he was wavering throughout the game and it just wasn't confident in the throws that he was making out there. I mean, you look at the turnovers, and we'll talk a lot more about those. Early on in the season, he threw two interceptions against Wake Forest. I wasn't really concerned about those. One was a tip pass that fell into the belly of a nose tackle. The other one was kind of just underthrew a ball just slightly, but the window was there. These, I don't know what he was doing. You know, they were the more con most concerning so far for me.
Yeah, I agree. And I went back and because I'm a glutton for punishment, I was rewatching the game this morning. No, I'm kidding. I write a what we learned from the game column for the Times Dispatch. And when I went back and rewatched the game this morning, I watched that fumble and the protection wasn't great, right? He had to flush from the pocket. He could have protected the football a little more, but he had it two hand. He wasn't
Yeah.
careful like a loaf of bread out wide. Like he wasn't crazy with it. That one to me was just your typical Virginia bad luck. Steen's foot comes up and hits it, and Calandria loses it. But the interceptions were hard to understand. On one of them, the protection was bad. But the one to Malachi Fields, and I know he came to the sideline and acted as if there was some miscommunication. But whatever it was, Malachi was covered, and he threw that ball high. So whatever it was they were seeing, even if he wanted Malachi to break that route up the field, there were guys there to cover him. So I was concerned by the turnovers, but by the interceptions in particular. But the thing to me, Preston, was they did not protect him well. I made a joke. I can't remember if I put it on Twitter or was just talking to some friends, but I said Anthony Calandria probably ran for 2,000 yards Saturday night, but he did it all scrambling behind the line of scrimmage. I mean, there were great plays he made too, but there were so many times where he was retreating, reversing field, spinning out. It was like the old Barry Sanders runs. And if you're my age and you're 45, and what you remember about Barry Sanders is him spinning and all that and breaking off long runs. But if you lived in the moment and you were a Detroit Lions fan, you remember how many times he got tripped up 12 yards behind the line of scrimmage trying some of that junk. And it felt like Calandria was doing that all game. It felt like the line was not protecting well. And I think more than the fumble, that's where you saw the confidence in the passing. Look, Maryland, like I said, adjustments. Maryland did a great job in the first half getting after him, but they kind of flushed him to his right. And he's pretty comfortable with that. In the second half, they did a really nice job of flushing him to his left. And that's where you saw an interception. You saw a ball that he kind of tucked and lost. They really got him out of sorts, I thought, with their pass rush.
Yeah, and we'll get a little bit more further into the offensive line because it was an interesting game for them, just injuries wise and performance wise. But overall, just kind of looking at a big picture here, how much of a missed opportunity was this game for them? You know, they haven't beaten an FBS non-conference game since 2022, and they haven't won a Power Four non-conference game since Illinois in 2021. Just missed opportunity, prime time game. You know, you had a lot more attention because I kind of made this point before the game. It was a weird week for like the prime time slate in college football. There were not a lot of big games going on.
No, I feel like a lot of people were tuning in to watch, and I thought they got a great crowd. I thought the turnout was really good. I thought the energy was really good. But at some point, and I know I talk to people all the time, oh, they got to do more in the stadium, more for the fan experience. You and I both noticed the new Cavman cartoon that they brought back. I think they did a nice job with that. They're doing those things. At the end of the day, when you're walking out of Scott Stadium, did your team win? Did they play well or not? That's still what it. And so I feel like they threw away a big opportunity off the field in terms of, hey, there were some people in that stadium. There were some people watching at home. They wanted to see you put out a product that made them say, hey, I wish I was there. And the people who were there say, hey, I want to come back. So I thought from a program building, fan engagement standpoint, they missed an opportunity. Preston, on the field, they missed a ton of opportunities. And this would have been a really important win. I mean, if they could have picked this win up, the path to again, we always sound like Steve Kornacki here, but the path to six wins and bowl eligibility, a lot easier with the win over Maryland there. And would have been good for the ACC. Virginia Tech threw one away with Vanderbilt. The league needs some of those games. And Boston College was competitive with Missouri, but didn't get it done. So I thought on like three different fronts, there was a real opportunity here to make some progress for Virginia football. And it was discouraging the way it went in the second half. Look, if you play great and Maryland plays great, and it's a great college football game. I'll always argue this. If you get a great crowd and primetime TV and play a great game, it doesn't matter big picture if you win or lose. It matters for your season. But in terms of all that other stuff, recruiting, energy, You can lose a close game, but when you come out and lay an egg in the second half, that's a discouraging way to go out.
Yeah, and I would agree on most of those counts, and it was interesting. You talk about, I guess, the attendance, and I was had a lot of conversations with people. The parking lots looked the best that they have in quite a while walking towards the game, and I was a little surprised by the number in the end. 41,352 was the official number. Little surprise there. I think the number everyone had kind of had in their heads was 46,000 going into it. And it's surprising to me because I didn't realize back at that Virginia Tech game in 2019, that was only 52,000. And I mean, growing up going to Scott Stadium, like I was used to seeing 60,000 regularly. And it's been a long time since then. The stadium has actually kind of shrunk in capacity since then as well. The record against USC, you can't even achieve that anymore because they're just not the capacity anymore.
Not legally,
Not
unless you want the fire marshal to show up.
legally, but you're not even having problems worrying.
No.
You don't have to worry about legality in Scott
Do
Stadium right
not.
now.
Yeah, I think if you're Virginia, you look back to that Florida State game a few years ago. It was a night game. They had a great crowd for that. At this point, it's not about selling out or filling. I mean, you want to, but it's about do you put a lot of people in the stadium and do you have a great atmosphere? That Florida State game had a phenomenal atmosphere. I thought the JMU game last year had a great atmosphere until everybody left, except for the JMU fans. I thought the Richmond game this year had a really good, atmosphere. Again, I think people lost interest and went home. The students packed the hill and then, realized there were other places they could be. I thought there was a good crowd, Maryland. I thought everything about Saturday night was a positive for Virginia until they came out of the second half and people were leaving and the team wasn't playing well. And it sort of, it really fizzled, right? That's what it was. But I thought when they kicked the ball off Saturday night, I thought this is a good night for Virginia football.
Yeah, the numbers don't scream, huge progress, but the atmosphere was great. And, having, kind of ACC Network be in town and kind of get kind of a little bit more interest that way. And, having, a lot of other stuff going on around grounds. I thought it was a good weekend for UVA off the field. As soon as, like you said, as soon as they started the second half on the field, that's kind of where the weekend ended. And we'll get a lot more into that coming up right after the break. Welcome back into the Who's On podcast. Right now, we're going to take a look into the offense. We've talked about Anthony Calandria a little bit in that first half. We're going to talk a lot more about him right now. Again, two interceptions, a fumble on the night for him, three of UVA's four turnovers. And also, interestingly, his first start without a passing touchdown in his career so far at UVA. He only had, actually, he's only had one game that he's played where he didn't throw a touchdown, and that's when he was thrown into emergency duty last year in the season opener against Tennessee. Mike, just overall, I mean, he's made strides this year. You can see the maturity. Where did it kind of get off the wheels for him in this game?
Yeah, and I don't know if it did. His completion percentage was pretty good, right? And one of the two interceptions I mentioned, the protection was terrible. They just never got into a rhythm as an offense. You go back and you watch that first opening drive, and I thought Kobe Pace's first carry was a really strong run. I thought X Brown's first carry was a really strong run. You get the Tyree score, right? Called back for the field. So it just seemed early on like they were in a rhythm. And then they got out of the rhythm and they had no answer. They had no way to get back into it. I'm going to keep coming back to the protection because I went back and I'll have to look at, I wish I had kept my notes with me, but I graded out Calandria's play and it was a very high number that he was under duress. And there were a high number of throws that he threw from outside the pocket, rolling to his right in the second half, more rolling to his left. I thought he still did a nice job with composure. There were a few moments that I will say where he was flushed, particularly going to his left, where he didn't do the thing that Anthony Calandria does that makes him special. He didn't keep his eyes downfield. There were a few times when he was flushed to the left, and again, give credit to Maryland for the amount of pressure he was under, but where if he had been able to keep his eyes up, he would have seen a guy downfield and he would have made one of those crazy Anthony Calandria plays where he scrambles to his right, rolls back to his left, shakes free of a tackle, and throws the ball. It didn't happen in this one, but I thought overall his accuracy was okay. I thought his decision making overall was okay. They just got out of rhythm.
Yeah, and you mentioned the numbers, and we'll probably get into the offensive line right after this, just because it's become such a big talking point early on in this season. And it's wild to look at the numbers afterwards because each team ended the game with one sack. Maryland had 7 quarterback hurries credited to Virginia's 4. That's not how it felt or looked at all on the field. It seemed like every time Calandria dropped back, he was either forced to flush out of the pocket or someone was up right up in his face right away. And in Virginia, on the vice versa, we'll talk about the defense later, but it did not seem like that way for Billy Edwards on the night. And so I think, yeah, and again, I mentioned earlier the two interceptions in this game were the first this season when I was like, red flag. That's a little alarming, especially, the first one, you talk miscommunication and, he throws it straight to a Maryland defender. Or the second one, he's trying to roll out of the pocket. And those are the oh crap plays, as Des Kitching said before the season. He makes so many oh wow plays, we gotta cut out the oh crap plays. And I think for the first time this season, really, you saw a little heavy dosage of he felt like he had to do a lot, and so he's trying to force it. Instead of oh wow, it turned to oh crap. On at least two of those interceptions.
Yeah, and I don't, here's my concern, Preston, is I don't know if you can get oh wow without some oh crap. Like, I think they're intrinsically linked. And you think about that second interception, right? I mentioned the pocket collapses. He's rolling around. He gets free. He should have been sacked on that play, probably, but he gets free. He gets to his left. He's running up. Now you think he's just going to tuck it out of bounds. And at the last second, he is keeping his eyes up and he sees Kobe pace up that sideline. And if he gets the ball over two Maryland defenders, it's a first down. It might be a touchdown. And we might be saying it's an oh wow, right? Those are the moments. The problem is you've got to recognize that you're in a tight game. And maybe what's the risk reward isn't there. Yeah, maybe you do. Maybe you pull that play off and it's a great moment. But if you don't, the damage you've done is now, it outweighs the good in that case. That's the next step for Anthony Calandria. It's not, can I make this play? Should I just throw this ball away? It's, there's a chance I can make this play. But if I don't, what does that mean for this game? I thought it on his touchdown run. I'll be honest. The touchdown run right before the half, and I know Tony Elliott got on for this too, like, it, everyone's like, wow, that was heady. He knew how much time was left. I don't think so. I think he
No.
was a kid. I think he was a kid on the playground with the Nerf ball, and the teachers were saying, recess is over. And he's like, I'm going to stick this ball in the end zone before we have the end of and that's what it was. And it's great because he made the great play and he's a competitive guy. I still think there's some big picture stuff that in the moment is eluding him. I thought it was on that run, even though it worked. And I thought it was on the interception and it didn't work.
Yeah, and I think you could chalk a lot of that up to, he's a sophomore quarterback. He's 19 years old. I mean, that's kind of what you're going to get at this stage of his career. And you got to take the oh crap with the oh wow plays. And to go back to that touchdown run just before the half, you can think all you want that he knew exactly how much time he had
No
no
chance.
idea.
No
He
chance.
was just going for it. And that's kind of he, after the game, he talked to Tyler Neville and he was like, he's confident. He's a gunslinger. That's what we want to see. Like, that's what makes him Anthony Calandria, and that's the positive.
It is. And he makes a lot of those plays. The question is, how much better is Virginia football if in that moment he realizes, hey, we need these points and gets down with 3 seconds so they can kick a field goal? Look, it didn't go that way on Saturday. He got the touchdown. But is there going to be a game that they lose by 3 points or less where he could have had and he didn't? Is there going to be a game where he throws that pick? And look, it's 50-50, man. Like, he may float a ball over two defenders, hit Kobe Pace for a touchdown. The stadium comes back to life. The offense gets a rhythm and they win the game. And you and I are sitting here saying that's the turning point, man, when he did that. But it's got to be, from a coaching standpoint, it's got to be the stick in the mud, the old fuddy-duddy who says, look, the risk there didn't outweigh the reward, whether it worked. I always go back to when I played. I was a terrible basketball player in high school, and I always remember my freshman coach, and I'd shoot a three, and I could hear him saying, no, 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 no. And usually it missed. But when it went in, even then, I'd come off, and he was like, let me explain to you why it was a bad shot. And it's not just because you're the one who took it. And you got, those are lessons you have to learn, because Virginia wants to get to a place where it's in close games with really good teams. And if you're in close games with really good teams, you can't make those mistakes.
Looking at the offensive line, we've mentioned it several times already. Mikhail Boley obviously still has yet to play a game. He's been day to day or week to week, however you want to call it, at this point, with a high ankle sprain. We'll see, how much longer he's going to be out. Brian Stevens was hurt in this game, and that was probably the most noticeable absence on the offensive line, just in the two, I think, two series he missed. And those are two of the shortest series Virginia had with the ball. So, and then he comes back, probably doesn't look himself either the rest of the game, and Ty Furnish goes out, and then you got Inanna coming in at right guard. I know Jimmy Chris came in and played some right tackle because Blake Steen really struggled on the night. Offensive line play, you talk about having all these starters back. If they're not out on the field together, that doesn't help you. And also, if they're not playing well, it doesn't help you.
Yeah, I asked so many times during preseason camp. I said, "Hey, I know you got all these guys back, but is it concerning that you haven't had the same five out there in practice yet?" And everybody kept saying, "Oh, it doesn't matter. We're cross-training. We're preparing everybody." But that's bull, right? The offensive line you always hear about. I mean, heck, in their online slogan, as not great as it is the fists, right? Like, I get why people don't love that as a slogan to begin with, but I'm saying you have to have those five guys together, and they haven't had it. They didn't have it in the preseason. They haven't had it this season. Boley being out is huge. Like, that's a big piece. Stevens getting hurt was a big piece. Ty Furnish was ill too. He was under the weather, and Ty Furnish has had his problems when he's healthy. So him being under the weather, then he's got to move over to center for a few. Like, it wasn't just a recipe for non-success. I hate to say failure, that might be too much, but the way they got beat in the second half it was failure because Maryland looked at that and said, "Hey, they're not playing well. They've got guys in and out." They went after Blake Steen, and I thought when Jimmy Crist came in, they went after Jimmy Crist. I think one of the interceptions, he got beat for the pressure that led to the interception. So, look, I think you need five guys playing together, and you need five guys playing at a higher level. And right now, they're not getting it. And look, offensive line is always going to derail you. Like, we can talk all day about how cool it is to watch Anthony Calandria go Barry Sanders back there. I wonder, and I was watching this, I think on both of his interceptions, on the snap before, he was doing that Barry Sanders nonsense, right? And look, he's in great shape, right? He's not a 45-year-old out-of-shape guy like me. He can run around all day, but you got to wonder, as a quarterback, you're running for your life. You're doing everything you can for a one-yard loss or a no gain. Then you come back and get the next snap. You're running up for your life again, and you throw a pick. I think it takes its toll on a young quarterback.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, this offensive line has got plenty of questions, but here's the case. You've got this game against Coastal Carolina, and then you got a bye week. You're hoping by then, Mikhail Boley is at least healthy enough to come back to action. You're hoping that maybe some nicks and bruises that you picked up earlier on the season, you can kind of let those heal, and maybe you start after the bye week against Boston College, which all of a sudden is a really tough Boston College team. They took Missouri to the wire on the road, a good SEC team. You're hoping maybe you have all five guys healthy for the home stretch, but in the reality, some of these guys are going to get banged up some more down the stretch. That's just how college football works. And it's been nice to see Jack Whitmer have some moments, after he made his move from tight end, and kind of get some experience. You've got Inanna as a guy that's experienced at least on the inside. And I know they've talked highly about true freshman Grant Ellinger too, but yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see if they could just be a little healthier after the bye week.
Yeah, because you're right. You have a chance to get healthy, but the reality is they haven't been all that good. So I always joke about this. When I started my career, I spent 2 months covering high schools before I moved up to cover JMU football. And I was interviewing a coach, and I said, "You got to be excited. You have 11 starters back on defense." And he said, "Well, we were pretty bad on defense last year." Like, sometimes you don't want guys back if they're. But the interesting thing I thought Saturday with Virginia's offensive line was when they came out in the first half running the ball, which is what I thought was going to be a problem. I thought they looked pretty good run blocking. I thought they did a nice job getting into Maryland's front, moving them, opening some holes. Now, the backs ran really well. I thought there were some really good second effort runs, but the offensive line was getting some push and opening some holes. I thought that was really encouraging. And you know how this works. Like, in your head, you're like, "Okay, what am I going to write about?" And I kind of had my idea for the column on defense, but I said, when I come back and do the what have we learned, I'm going to praise the offensive line because they're really establishing the run. And when I ended up writing the damn thing on Monday morning, it was how bad the offensive line pass protected. But don't lose sight of early on, I thought there were some encouraging signs about how they ran the football.
That's a really interesting point because it seems like, as much as Tony Elliott talks about establishing the run ever since he got to Virginia, they are awfully quick to abandon the run in any tight game. Not even if, they're chasing the game as they have been the last 2 weeks against Wake Forest and Maryland. It's even in the first half, like, it's a tight ball game. It's, one score, you're even in the lead. They're not running the ball as efficiently or as often as they normally do. And that's, kind of been the case in the red zone too a couple of times. And we'll talk about the red zone struggles right now. They they rank 71st in the country in red zone offense right now, which doesn't seems so bad when you look at, oh, they're 10 out of 12, but that's five field goals compared to five touchdowns. And everyone knows if you get in the red zone, you need six, you don't need three. And that's been a huge problem for them early on. Just what have you thought of the play calling, I guess, when you get down into the red zone? And the player said it's more execution, but what are you seeing in your rewatch?
It certainly is execution, right? You can go back and watch their red zone snaps, think about the play call, and watch where it falls apart. But I used to have this argument with Scott Leffler when he was the offensive coordinator at Virginia Tech all the time. At some point, you have to recognize that it's not a perfect play call if your guys repeatedly don't execute it, right? So for him, it was, hey man, we had this guard miss a block on the kick out. If he makes that, we're walking in for the touchdown. Okay, week one, week two, week three, okay. Week 9, 10, 11, 12, I don't want to hear it anymore because that kid's missed the block. You got to know your. I think, to your point, I think they're giving up on the run too quickly. I think they're being too clever and too creative. I think they're going Robert and I and outsmarting themselves in the red zone. Look, Tony Elliott didn't just say he wants the identity to be running the football, which he did, and I've written about that a ton. But he also said, I want to be a team that when we get inside the 10, we're going to just run it down your throat. And if you want to be that team, well, then you got to call those plays. And I think you've got backs in Kobe Pace, in X Brown, who will give you the second effort, right? If the line doesn't blow them off the ball, you still got a chance. I mean, before the play before Calandria's fumble, X Brown was stopped at the line. They got a good little push, then he stopped. It's probably a 1 yard gain. He keeps his legs moving and he spins off that pile and he gets a couple of yards. Do that three times. Heck, do it four times. Show the commitment of we're going to do it. Instead, they ran the play with Calandria that resulted in the pocket breaking down. It results in the fumble. Yeah, okay. If he doesn't fumble it, maybe it's a different. But give your team a chance with what they were doing well. And I'd like to see them line up and just go power. Look, they did it right at the end of the weight game. We all love the Grady Bunch. We all love when Grady. But I do. I like that play, and I like having it in the repertoire. But I want to see you line up with your regular personnel and go get yards. And I think they're getting away from that in the red zone because they feel like we're going to need these points. But I think for growing the program, you need those yards. You need to learn how to get them. And I'd like to see them stick with it. And the other thing was, hey, Calandria is a great runner. They didn't run him much, but you go back and watch the plays, and I wonder if it wasn't Maryland did a nice job of pressuring him to the point of. Now it's not an RPO anymore, right? Because the play's broken and they had people shadowing, they had people in front. So he wasn't going to get the yards. You look at the interception, right? He comes free up that left side. He's got a little room, but he's not getting much. There's people waiting for him, which is why he throws the ball. And we just went over all that. I thought Maryland did a nice job of taking the Calandria run game away as a play call. And then I thought Virginia hurt itself by not calling traditional runs.
Yeah, and I went back as for this article on the Sabre.com, I went back and looked at what play calls are they doing. So in the 34 plays that they ran in the red zone this year, which excludes the field goals, it's been 23 runs versus 11 pass. And that sounds like a great, balance right there, because you talk about wanting to run the ball more when you get inside the 20. It's been 10 rushes for Kobe Pace for 3.2 yards per carry. Xavier Brown's had three rushes, and he's averaging 4.6 yards per carry on those runs. You got to give the ball more to this guy because he can make some plays even in tight space like that.
And I'd love to know what of those yards were after contact because he's been really good about keeping his legs moving. And look, some of it is you get to third down and you're starting to feel desperation. I get that. I'd almost rather see a first or second down play action pass and then commit to the run. But I'd like to see three or four runs in a row, man. And look, everybody likes to get cute and throw it out wide or try to, but the reality is it hasn't been working. And it is frustrating when you think about like a Malachi Fields. He seems like the kind of guy you should be able to throw an end zone fade to and score on. But that's not the play call we're getting either, right? We're getting a lot of toss out wide, and then you still have to make the yards. If it's third and goal from the five, you're getting no yards on the pass, and you're trying to get. And I think you're making it harder for yourself. Look, if you want to take a shot in the end zone with Malachi Fields, I get it. He's a big target. I probably will bang on you less. But if it's not that, I want to see you line up and run the football in.
Well, it's great that you mentioned that because I had those stats too. They have thrown to Malachi Fields and Tyler Neville, their two biggest targets in the red zone, seven times this year. Take a guess how many of those were actually in the end zone, though.
That's my concern. Yeah, I'm guessing not even half.
It's
It's
one time,
and
and
that's
it
the
was against Wake
problem.
Forest, and it was broken up on a play where the defensive back had inside leverage, and so you would think, all right, outside fade, though they go slant right into the coverage, and it's deflected.
Right. And that's my thing is, look, if you want to throw the jump ball fade to Malachi Fields, I'm not going to argue with you because that's a unique talent. But I just think and that's really good numbers because it's not just about did you call a run or did you call a pass? It's what are you calling? You're calling passes that are ostensibly running plays because you're catching the ball at or behind the line of scrimmage and you still got to go make those tough yards. Well, if you got to make the tough yards anyway, I want you to make them with Kobe Pace. I want you to make them with X Brown. I want to make you to make them behind your offensive line. I don't want you to make them out on the perimeter. That's not what it's for. And that's, I think, the frustration is, hey, you want to give me a crossing route in the back of the end zone with Tyler Neville? You want to give me a fade in the corner with Malachi Fields? If you don't get it, I'm going to criticize that a lot less than the cutesy out wide stuff where now you've got guys trying to break a tackle and it's not working. It's not working.
No, it's not. And even I mentioned Kobe Pace 3.2 yards. That's a good number in the red zone because it is tight down there. It is hard to get yards. If you're giving me 3 yards on your 3+ yards on, 3 straight carries, that's a first down and you're probably in the end zone.
Hey, or give me four. Give him four carries.
Four, yeah.
If you're averaging 3.2, I can do the math. That means he's going to be at the back of the end zone on the fourth carry. That's perfect. You got to commit to it. Look, and I understand that fourth and one, obviously, it's tough to run the football. Everybody knows exactly what's coming. But hey, honestly, if you run it, run it, run it, and you're fourth and one, you might have a play action pass there. But you've got to establish yourself as a team that can do it. And right now, if I'm scouting Virginia, I'm not worried about them powering the ball down my throat in the red zone. And that makes it harder to throw it and to do all the other things.
And speaking of, red zone, third quarter, and this third one, the third down struggles are the three things I kind of highlighted after this game. UVA ranks 130th in third down percentage this season. I don't know if you know how many teams are in college football, but it's only like two more after
There ain't many
that.
after Virginia. And it's, again, some of it is play calling, some of it's decision making, but a lot of it is, and I think Tony Elliott, I believe he spoke about this after the game, but it's getting yourself in trouble on first and second down, right? And it's doing some things and making some decisions. You put yourself in third and long, or you put yourself in, I always call it third and predictable. Right? It becomes real easy for the defense to stop you if they know what's coming. And I feel like Virginia has spent a lot of time either in third and long or third and predictable instead of being third and short. And now what are they going to do? Right? Third and two at the 48. Well, now, hey, is this two down territory? Do we have to worry about play action? Are they going to bootleg Calandria? Is it going to be a quarterback run? Are they going to line up and just jam it down our throats? They're putting themselves in position that it's easier to defend early in the count, early in downs. But yeah, you still have to be a team that can convert. And the concern for me Saturday night was Calandria's, oh wow, should be coming on third downs, right? That should be the moment where you're like, you got a play call, it didn't work, but we got a guy who's going to make a guy miss and keep the drive alive. And we didn't get that. Again, he did a great job avoiding sacks, but so much of his moves and his running was behind the line of scrimmage. I think that factors into third down. It's can you keep the pressure off Calandria so that he's choosing to make a play with his legs, or is he being forced to make a play with his legs by great defense? Saturday night, Maryland was dictating what was happening.
No, absolutely. And a lot has been made earlier this year just kind of on big plays for this Virginia offense. And I know the number for them is they want to have at least 12 explosive plays per game, but and they're getting close to that pretty much every game, but a lot of times it's first or second down, they get a big gain and then they kind of stall out after that because they can't string together a couple plays in a row. And that's when you're seeing like they're not efficient on first and second down, and that's what gets them into those long ones, Third and 9+ in this game against Maryland, they were 0-for-5. Not really surprising because that's really hard to convert consistently. And you're hoping for some oh wow from Calandria in those situations, but you can't always rely on oh wow in those situations. Let's flip to the defense, a little bit more of a positive for Virginia on the day. Basically, you can title this defense this year "Bend but Don't Break" because that's kind of what they've done all season. And I know you wrote about it. Four turnovers for this Virginia offense and held Maryland to just 7 points.
Yeah, and most importantly, stop them cold after the first three, where it was really momentum, and it's why I wrote about them. It felt like they were seizing control of the game there. That no matter what the offense did, the defense was there. And you do. I thought they wore down a little. I thought Maryland did a nice job with their play calling of attacking the weak spot of this Virginia defense, which is still the corners. So I thought they did a nice job of adjusting. But yeah, I was encouraged by Virginia defense right from the start. If you remember the very first third down for Maryland. And they go over the middle, and Antonio Clary comes up and makes a great play on the ball. It gets it right as the ball does, breaks it up. And I thought that really set the tone. Then the next drive, Jonas Sanker did the same thing on a second down play. And I thought, the best part of this defense right now is the play of the safeties. Clary and Sanker have been outstanding. They've been really setting the pace, setting the tone for this team. So I really like that. The defensive line, I thought they did a good job of getting some pressure. They need to do a better job of finishing, getting to the quarterback, getting him on the ground. But I thought they were disruptive. I thought they missed Cam Robinson, the linebacker, right? Cam is a guy who not only is he a great player, but he's a mistake eraser. He can run sideline to sideline. So if something springs free, he can clean it up. And I thought they missed that element in the game, although I thought James Jackson was very sturdy, right? James is not as fast as Cam Robinson, but James has great anticipation. He has great understanding. So sometimes he's a step slower, but he's a step ahead because of his anticipation. I thought he played a good game. But overall, I was encouraged by the defense. I'm concerned about what they have at corner. I'm certainly concerned about the depth, right? We saw when guys go out, Maryland smartly attacking, second and third string corners, and they got the touchdown against Kendron Smith, who was number three, the third option there. But I thought overall I was encouraged by the defense.
A great segue because next up was the cornerback play. And it was literally that moment. I had literally just looked at, all right, Dre Walker's on the field now. All right, Kimpton Shine's off. All right, Dre Walker just got hurt. Oh, Kendron Smith. Oh, wait, touchdown. That was literally as I was processing it, Maryland was processing in the same time and being like, let's target that guy never at number four and get, and they got a touchdown right off that play.
Yeah, I think it was some people were almost surprised they didn't go right at him, but it was, if I'm remembering right,
I think it was the second.
it was the second play. It was third and two. So they picked up the first down. They're like, let's run and get the first down. And then the first pass they threw targeted him. They got the touchdown behind him. But if you got to remember, Tony Elliott, look, the beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and it's a double-edged sword, and whatever cliche you want to dump on me right here. But he was talking about the pass breakups. And three of the pass breakups, I hated. One was Jam Jackson got completely beat and he made a great job recovering to knock a ball away. But you can't ignore the fact that he got completely beat for what would have been a touchdown. Again, great competitiveness, great recovery speed, great hand placement to get his right arm around and knock a ball away. But I'm concerned with him getting beat off the line like that for what could have been a touchdown. Two more of them, Trey McDonald gets a pass breakup on a ball that hits him in the face. I'd love to see him catch the ball, right? That's an interception. Another one was Corey Thomas, right? The Akron transfer in the end zone. And he catches the ball in stride, doesn't get his feet down, but there's no reason as a defensive back to catch it in stride. That's where you stop and high point it and get the interception. So, yes, they were disruptive in that regard, but there were some plays there. And I just named three different positions too, but there were some plays there on the ball that were breakups that one was them getting beaten, could have been a touchdown. So, thank goodness there's a recovery. And two should have been interceptions.
No, absolutely. And that was a point that I was curious just what they would say, because this Virginia defense under John Rudzinski has never been big on creating turnovers. And I know you ask him and he's like, oh, it's not a focus for them, they would say. But ask Jonas Sanker about it, who last year had 11 pass deflections, no interceptions. We're still 3 games into this. They have not had an interception yet, and they've only forced two fumbles. And I know one of those is a massive play down at Wake Forest, but is it concerning for them if they're not turning the getting these turnovers? And he said, yeah, that's something that we need to work on. We need to have better awareness. There's a couple times when they're playing great coverage, but they need to turn their head around because the Maryland quarterback's throwing it right to them.
Yeah, I think since the day he got here, John Rudzinski's talked about they want to be a bend but don't break defense. They want to be a little bit off, in between the 20s and then tighten up in the 20s. And I think they do it well. I don't have a problem with his scheme. I think what's happening here is we've gone from you're not emphasizing turnovers, right? You're not trying to zone blitz. You're not trying to trick somebody into throw you the football. To you're playing great defense. You're in position for the turnover and you're letting it get away from you. It's one thing if you don't want to be a gambling defense trying to undercut routes. That's fine. The problem is when you play great defense and they throw you the football, you need to start catching it, right? And that has to be a more of a focal point. It's not about gambling and undercutting routes. That's not who they want to be. They want to keep things in front of them. They want to be Kihei Clark at the front of the pack line defense, right? They want to keep it in front of them. But when they throw you the ball, you need to catch the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's and it only emphasizes the turnovers that the Virginia offense has even more because you're not counting on getting one of those takeaways back. And that's why the fumble against Wake Forest was so surprising because it doesn't happen very often. And even just over the course of UVA history, they don't get those kind of lucky plays where, the ball pops out right when Wake Forest gets into field goal position. And so I guess just going forward, can they create any kind of turnovers just down the stretch of the season? I'm not banking on it just interception wise. It doesn't seem like the corners are, those kind of ball hawks, and the safeties, they seem like they're in great positions and we talk about how good they are, but they have not. Jonas Sanker has one interception for his career. I watched him in high school. He was mainly a quarterback, running back, wide receiver, played defense, made some of his interceptions, but it hasn't translated to the college level. So
Yeah, and I know they always joke, well, if they could catch, they'd be on offense. But look, Sanker and Clary, to me, they're going to win the turnover battle by forcing fumbles. I mean, those guys come downhill and they hit you. And yeah, I'd love to see them. Again, this isn't a big jump the route defense, but I would love to see them on a contested ball come down with it. I think the turnovers are going to have to be from the defensive front. And when I say that, I mean so much pressure that the quarterback throws a ball that is so stupid and so hopeless that the defense has no choice but to catch it. I mean, even the Trey McDonald, I think he should have had it, but that was a ball that had some zip. The quarterback was
yeah.
able to step in and throw, and I mean, you watch it carom off his face mask, it went pretty far, right? The defense needs to create some pressure. The blitzes, and it was an interesting defensive game plan because a week ago at Wake, they were blitzing everybody, right? They were getting their sacks from linebacker and safety. This week against Maryland, and it worked. They mostly were rushing four, and I thought it was still effective. So I like that part of the defensive game plan. But what I need to see is the pressure that creates throws that are so terrible, you have no choice but to catch the football. Like the Anthony Calandria floated interception over field. I want to see balls like that. If you can get that pressure, I think Sanker, Clary, I think those corners, I think they'll make those plays. But yeah, you're right. I don't think these are the kind of guys that are going to just be winning and jumping routes. And it's not in their DNA and it's not in the game plan.
All right, well, let's move ahead. We've talked about this Maryland game. Now, next up, an opportunity on the road at Coastal Carolina. And I had a little bit of fun because, you don't get all the many of these group of five road games where, you got the so-called, big guys and the power four going on the road to play these group of five teams. And looking since 2000, Virginia's had actually 10 of these games, true road games. There's the Navy, bowl game up in Annapolis, but we won't count that towards this number since it was technically a bowl game in a neutral field. 2021 was their last one. Everyone remembers that Bronco Mendenhall's return to BYU and the offensive fireworks that ensued late out in Utah. But over these 10 games since 2000, they've played on the road at group of five teams. They are 4-6. They are 1-4 in their last five games. I think we've seen over the years, whether it's UNC at App State or Virginia Tech on the road against Old Dominion, they got the win this year. But in the past
We lost
years,
the first two.
we've seen these teams get up for it. And we heard, Coastal Carolina coach Tim Beck say, it's hard to find a ticket right now for this game. So what are you expecting just briefly about this environment on the road for Virginia?
Oh, I think it's going to be really good. Now, if you remember, Conway, South Carolina, people started with the baseball team, and they had really good crowds in Conway for baseball. And then you saw it a little bit for football. The problem was one of their big breakthrough years was COVID, so attendance was limited because of that. I think there's a lot of excitement in Conway. I've been down there for games, for big games at the 1AA level, right? When they were playing there and it was JMU, and they would get big crowds. And so I think this is going to be a great atmosphere. I think it's going to be a hostile atmosphere. I think Virginia will be okay with all of that. My bigger concern is I think Coastal Carolina ends up being pretty good. I think we all kind of wrote them off when Grayson McCall left. And instead, Grayson's been kind of disappointing. And Coastal Carolina without him still been pretty darn good. So I think this is a tougher game, the way they run the football. But I think it's going to be a great crowd. Tim Beck told us this morning, said it's going to be electrifying. And I think that's right. I think the people in Conway are going to turn out for the event. But I think they've got a good enough football team, and that's what happens in these games. You turn out for the event. Wow, we're hosting a Power Five. We're hosting an ACC team. That's a big deal. And then you're sitting in the stands, and you got your beer and your hot dog, and you're having the moment, and you're like, "Hey, man, we're in this game."
I
And
got a
that's where that
chance.
atmosphere, yeah, it just ratchets up another level because you got the butts in the seat. This goes how, but you don't talk out your butt. I know politicians do, but if you're a fan, you got your butt in the seat. Now you're going to start yelling. You're getting into it, and that is the danger for a Virginia or a Virginia Tech going to Old Dominion is you give them that life. And look, so for Virginia, it's going to be two things. It's going to be get off to that big start, take the crowd out of it a little bit, and it's going to be halftime when all those fans are thinking, "Are we leaving early or not?" Don't come out and lay another egg in the third quarter because that's just going to breathe life back into that crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Virginia's had the chance this season to get off to fast starts, but they sputtered out in the red zone or whatever it may be. And so, can they get off to a better start against Coastal Carolina? We'll see. Big week ahead. We'll see what Virginia does as they go into their last game before the bye week. Want to thank Mike Barber from the Richmond Times-Dispatch for joining us today on the Who's On podcast. And we will see you guys later in the week with a preview for that Coastal Carolina game. See ya.
Thank you.